Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX and the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. This program is made possible through underwriting by Joan Gallart Sargent. Fred Monroe is hosting the program from home today amid continuing concerns about the spread of the COVID-19 virus. Fred and his guests will continue the Earth Month discussion examined last week on Central Coast Voices by Chris Kington Barker. Today we will gain a better understanding of not only climate change-related issues, but also how environmental justice plays a critical role in how we address these issues. Joining Fred and his guests for what will be a lively examination of why these issues are still with us and why they cannot be ignored by any of us anymore. You're invited to listen, learn, and participate in the conversation today. You can call us at 805-549-8855 or email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. Now let's join Fred and his guests.
Thank you, Brad. This is Fred Monroe. Glad you're with us today. Good afternoon. Welcome to Central Coast Voices. Our goal is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. We want to address today's choices and how they will affect tomorrow's communities. In some cases, those are choices we've been delayed on addressing directly, which is one of the reasons why we are probably having this kind of discussion today. Scientists around the world have agreed that pollution and habitat destruction are really being, there's an exploitation of natural resources that is going on that has really created a climate emergency, and currently it's quite out of control. In California and on the Central Coast, we are experiencing these effects firsthand. Reports indicate that more than half of California is once again in the middle of a severe drought, and that is not making us very comfortable as we think about the 2021 fire season. We will be looking at a number of aspects today. In the second half an hour, we'll be talking with folks from CAUSE, which is the Central Coast Alliance United for Sustainable Economies. That will be in the second half an hour. In the first half an hour, we're going to be talking with Mary Szczesinski, who's the executive director of EcoSlow, and Lexi Bell, who's the executive director of the Morro Bay Natural Estuary Program, and Eric Viam, who is the chairman of the Slow Climate Coalition. And they're with us today. When we bring environmentalists together, I think one of the things we would like to talk about is have a very good sense that things are, people are aware of what's going on and the change is happening and we're moving forward. I think at this point we are kind of in a situation where hopefully people are paying better attention. So I think I'll probably start with Mary. Can you give us a sense of whether or not you feel like anybody is starting to pay attention? I guess that's the easiest way to put it.
That's a great question, Fred. Thanks for having me on the show. And I guess I'm going first. I think what I've witnessed in my time with EcoSlow over the past few years is that there is a very strong investment from the folks who first celebrated Earth Day 51 years ago, and that there's an even stronger energy with youth, with those who are in high school, in college, coming right out of college, and they're thinking about climate as part, and the environment. It's a part of the conversation. It's not, so I do think that there is, it's being talked about more, especially with the youth. They're not afraid to talk about these hard things. It definitely can feel overwhelming, but I sense a really strong energy from that demographic. We can see it with groups that have formed in communities and nationally and internationally. So I think the conversation is being talked about more and with the urgency.
In our second half an hour, when we talk with the folks from CAUSE, we're going to look at a lot of economic issues that also affect minority populations. And that's a discussion that I think has become to the forefront. I'm glad that we're able to have those folks on a little later in the program and we'll have that discussion. I do my best to try and look at this as a non-political issue, but the reality is I believe that a good portion of the United States and the world, but the United States specifically, still looks at this as a rather political discussion. The phrase climate denial I thought would never exist, but for some reason it does exist. And I will pose that kind of as an open question to all three of you as to how you see that and whether or not you see any improvement in the way it's being looked at.
Fred, I'll jump in on this. Again, thanks for having the Slow Climate Coalition represented. I want to just start by saying that the coalition works at the intersection of justice and climate and economy. And to answer your question, if you look at the trends nationally and locally and even regionally, what's happening is that there's a major transformation happening in energy and an environment that's bringing people together, right? That there's the process of decarbonization is a huge economic opportunity. And we're already seeing innovation and investment and stakeholders who I'd say historically have been on the opposite side of the conversation really coming in, right? And so you saw recently the coal workers union joining on with Biden's energy plan because of the promise of just transition. If you look here regionally, we've got huge economic opportunities with offshore floating wind, with the battery park that's proposed at the Morro Bay power plant, with, you know, to bring in our ranchers and farmers because of the need for sequestration and the potential to increase the soil health of their working lands, and that there's going to be resources and technical support for all those folks. And so I see the kind of climate denial conversation really sunsetting and us actually in a new world where there's a lot of buy-in because of the recognition and for urgency and resources that are coming to support action.
So are we looking at a broader discussion, or we're looking at an acknowledgement that problems are better understood, I guess? And I pose that to all three of you, and actually, well, Lexi, you haven't been part of the discussion yet, and I think you may see some of it firsthand because the National Estuary Program for Morro Bay is visible to you daily. I mean, I'm not being sarcastic when I say this. You probably have one of the pleasures that a lot of us don't have, and that is that you're working in an environmental field where what you're responsible for being a steward of is very visible to not only the community but the surrounding area. So are we doing a better job of understanding a lot of this?
That's a great question, and I echo the thanks for including the Morro Bay Estuary Program in the conversation. That is one of my favorite things about working at the Estuary Program is that if you climb Black Hill in Morro Bay State Park, you can literally see the entire watershed, which is the whole area of land that drains into the bay. And so that is a really tangible thing to be able to see the entire landscape we're working on. And I think we are doing a better job of understanding the problem. I think that's one of the areas that we try to support the community in providing data and scientific information to our community about. There's a ton of information out there about what climate change means and all the different changes that might happen or might not happen and different emission scenarios. And it can be like an alphabet soup and confusing. So we tried to take that and distill it down to here's what we think will actually happen in Morro Bay based on all this other information. And I think we're getting to a point where we have some consensus around some of those impacts in terms of increased temperatures, sea level rise, mapping efforts, changes in precipitation, you know, these drought events coupled with more intense storms, but we get them less often. So we're starting to really have a good handle on those things. And I think the challenge for our community and our region is to move beyond that conversation about is climate change real and how it's going to happen to here's what we're going to do about it. And I think Eric put a number of good examples on the table for things the community is doing to actually put solutions forward. And I do think we're seeing a lot of that locally. We're not sitting around not doing anything locally.
What comes to mind for the work that you're doing is that we've talked a lot about the environmental pollution specifically beyond climate change issues. I mean, if I think one more time about soda bottles and the little soda bottle six pack straps in the environment, it's very frustrating to think about that. But the flip side may be, if I can feel optimistic for a moment, that hopefully you are seeing an awareness from the general public that is physically evident. And frankly, if it's not physically evident, let's be real honest about it.
We have an issue where as people's habits change and there is more awareness, then we move on to the next thing that we have to address. And so we've definitely seen an improvement. I mean, our water quality is a good indicator of that, and seeing less runoff into the bay and bacteria levels being lower. So we have a real commitment to stewardship locally, I think, of our coastal areas and our natural environments. And we do see that. But I also think we see the importance of not losing that momentum. So we had a lot of examples of that with people being outside more during the past year of pandemic conditions and seeing more marine debris. That was a good example of something that, we talked about this forever. Maybe everyone who usually went to the beach kind of started to get this message. Now we have a whole new audience, which isn't a bad thing. It's a great thing to have more people out there and engaging with the natural environment. But maybe we have to revisit some of those things we thought people kind of were coming around to. But we also see that people, there can be change in a community. I think one great example is picking up after your pet. I mean, nobody did that ever, right? 30 years ago. And now we have a real cultural expectation of that. And so we can make those changes that stick.
Yeah. I pose this primarily to Mary and Eric, and that is both of your organizations I would classify as being key in the process of agitating for change. The Climate Coalition and EcoSlow probably wouldn't need to be around if everybody was doing what they should be doing in the first place and didn't have to have, a mother or parent, if you will, to scold them for irresponsible behavior. I guess where I want to go with this is to you, Eric, and that is the very existence of the Climate Coalition. You can give us some history if you would, but I would assume a lot of what you do happens because the rest of us aren't doing what we should be doing.
Sure. Thanks for that, Fred. You know, let me just start by saying that like change doesn't ever just happen, right? Like it's, if you look at the entire history, it's always taken people organizing, raising their voices, bringing their issues to the agenda, electing good people who are going to have our agendas and take action around that agenda. And so really like that, the origin of the Climate Coalition goes back to how do we affect significant impactful change on the Central Coast. And what we recognized 15 years ago was that the most powerful tool available to take control of our local energy future, energy and economic future, is community choice energy. And so we started 15 years ago now, organizing, educating, and advocating to create a community choice program, which is our locally controlled energy provider, which is now serving five counties from Santa Barbara, all the way up to Santa Cruz, with the exception of San Luis Obispo County, but all the cities except Atascadero are involved. So that was really the first thing that the predecessor organization of the Climate Coalition did. And now the Climate Coalition is working in partnership with local governments, in coalition with a whole variety of different organizations to shape policy and programs at our community choice program and supporting leadership in our communities and region more broadly.
It was a somewhat passing line, but I can't let it go away. So all of the cities in the region are participating with the exception of one?
So Atascadero is not yet on board, and the county of San Luis Obispo is not yet on board. But every other jurisdiction between Santa Barbara County and San Benito County and Santa Cruz are on board. They'll come along soon.
Are they giving you any feedback as to why they don't want to be on board at the moment?
I think it's really a matter of I'm trying to be political here. It's really been the decision of the board majority not to allow the residents of the county to take advantage of that program, and which is creating savings and prioritizing local investment. And so I think that in time, we will have the county join, and it may take change in political leadership.
Okay. Are there individual supervisors who've been candid for you about what their primary concern is?
I think that in all of the conversations that have been had, in particular for our community choice program, that we have really gone over and above to address any of those concerns. I mean, our community choice program has $150 million in financial reserves. It's an extremely financially conservative organization that's stable and is representative with local control. So it's unclear to me, besides perhaps being just an ideological opposition, why they're not getting on board at this point.
Yeah. I want to remind our listeners that this is a discussion you can be part of if you'd like. You can give us a call at 805-549-8855. Your questions will be put on the air for our guests if you choose to do so. You can also email us at voices@kcbx.org. If you have a rather complex or elaborate question that we can't get to on the air, we will pass your email along to our guests to be part of that discussion. Mary, EcoSlow has been around for as long as there's been an Earth Day. I think about the same, I don't know if it's the same year or 1 year before we had an Earth Day. Do you get a sense that we've learned anything? I mean, I hate to say it, a good portion of all of our lives have been taken up with this topic that's not really getting addressed very well. And I'm wondering what we've learned and whether or not we've learned anything.
Thanks, Fred. So EcoSlow is celebrating 50 years of being in the community this year. We were loosely organized starting in 1969. So you could argue that we've been around just even slightly longer than Earth Day. But yes, EcoSlow has had quite the trajectory in the community. And I think that can be seen in EcoSlow's history. We were first formed because of businesses dumping in Slow Creek. There was no protection over our water. And that change in the 70s. So change, did start even then. And then EcoSlow became the recycling center for Slow County for 20 or 30 years. And now we have a government system that manages all of our trash and waste and now green waste. There's definitely complications there that I think is getting unpacked, especially recently, about what is actually going on in recycling and a lot of marketing that has been greenwashing for several years. But I think that there's digging and investigating that hasn't been done in a while. There's nothing to hide behind. And I think that is something that probably technology has, for better or for worse, you can't hide behind some things that maybe were easier to hide 50 years ago. And so there, I think that has definitely changed too. EcoSlo has always been an environmental organization and an advocacy organization. And that's changed over the years based on local issues. I've always found it challenging too of, you know, EcoSlo is the environmental center of SLO. We serve all of SLO County. That in itself is daunting. And that it's really important to be mindful of groups and organizations that are working in a local or regional level versus organizations that are working on a national or international level. And there's different purposes and there's different strategies to each one. And so I think there's ways that people can get involved based on what their interests are. So I think a lot has changed in 50 years. Obviously, a lot more has to change, especially within the next 5 or 10 years. I think I'll leave it there.
Okay. Well, as you were talking about that, one of the things that comes to mind for me that is a frustration, and there may be a decent answer, but I'm concerned there may not be. And that was that we've had this, the state of California has had this outstanding program, one of the first to have any kind of redemption value program for containers, which has, I mean, we are still paying those redemption fees for any container that we purchase product in. But it seems like that entire program, I'm not sure if it just got ignored or it went away for some other reason, but I don't know that it's a critical part of our environmental process, but the fact that it is just fallen by the wayside and nobody's paying attention to it concerns me, because we're talking about trying to have a more aware community, and we don't seem to have it in a lot of areas. I suspect there's a lot of people that are under the age of 35 or so that probably don't have much recollection of what that redemption program was all about. There are no redemption centers anymore.
Right.
It may not be an important factor. For a layman like me, it seems like it should be an important factor.
Well, I think one of the points that you make, redemption, that's typically with glass, aluminum, and with number one and number two plastic. Plastic is where the big confusion lies. And if you unpack that, there's ties to the fossil fuel industry and greenhouse gas emissions. And so it is really interconnected. But I think the thing that's getting unpacked in that sector of resources and environmentalism and, you know, what are we doing is thinking about, well, we've put everything away and now where is away? We're starting, you know, we see our landfills, we see it ending up in our environment. And so I think what I was kind of saying earlier around plastics is it's tied to the fossil fuel industry. There's been a lot of marketing and greenwashing about what is actually recyclable or not. And so as people in this community, we've been thinking, oh, I'm doing the right thing, I'm recycling it, when actually it's just going away and probably in the landfill or somewhere else. And so I think it's just a piece of the conversation. But when you unpack that, you have to understand the economics of it too. There has to be a market for the aluminum, for glass, for paper, for plastic. And there's just not really a market for plastic. And so it's getting totally flipped on its head because there isn't a market where people want to buy plastic that's been used and then use it again. And then you think about where it originally sourced from, and it's sourced from fossil fuel. So last point is that when EcoSlo had the recycling center in the 80s and 90s, we didn't recycle plastic. Plastic was not common, and it's really infiltrated our community in the past 20 or 30 years, our world, not just our community, the entire world. And so to me, one thing that I try and hold on to is something can change so quickly in 20 or 30 years that it can change in another way in 20 or 30 years too. That's how quickly our society, I think, changed. I think plastic is a really good example for that.
Yeah, you make some very good points. What comes to mind also is that we're not talking about it. I mean, if you walk down the aisle of the supermarket, there are still cases and cases of individual serving bottled water and soft drinks that are in plastic containers. People are still paying the redemption value on it. So it doesn't look like anybody's using it less. Maybe the numbers have gone down over the last 40 years enough that I haven't noticed that that's not as much of the beverage aisle anymore as it was. But I want to piggyback on some of the things you said, and that is that the fact that there seems to be an environmental awareness about climate change, but in some ways lack of an awareness about what actually creates climate change. And I think that's part of what Eric's addressing too. And maybe you can elaborate a little, Eric, about how we draw the public into this dialogue that may not need to make them more politically aware. We may need to make them just more scientifically aware.
Yeah, that's a good question, Fred. You know, I think that, you know, education about the basics of climate are helpful. That's not the thing that calls people to action, though, right? Like the thing that calls people to action is actually feeling the effects in their communities. And so that's why I think it's really great that Cause is going to be on after this segment, so we can hear more about the impacts of environmental pollution on communities, and also allowing people to participate and to benefit from it. So one thing that I wanted to share is electric vehicles, right? Right now there are incentives and a program I want to share. If you go to electricdrive805.org, which is a regional portal for electric vehicles, you can connect to how to qualify for a free or low cost electric vehicle. So there are incentives available, particularly for income qualifying people, where they can buy or lease for low or no money down an electric vehicle. And so it's like, that's how you start to get people. You get the first electric vehicle on your block, and then your neighbors start to see it, and you're telling the story about it. This happened in my case. I got solar. My neighbor got solar. Then he got his electric vehicle. Then he got a heat pump. You know, it became a over the fence type conversation, and that is a way to get people to start taking action, and then that helps to support political efficacy. Really saying like, we want more of this. So that's, I think, the way forward is you get people to participate, you have them see the benefits for themselves, and then they start demanding it from both the market and from community leadership.
Yeah, we have a couple of minutes left, and we did get a question from Thomas that basically, hold on, let me pull it back up here. Sorry about that. Specifically, what can be done by the individual consumer to reduce plastic use when it is so prevalent in the marketplace?
Go ahead, Lexi, if you want to take that one.
I was just going to say, don't buy it. I think Thomas hit the nail on the head in that it is super challenging as a consumer. Like you said, Fred, it's out there everywhere. So if you try not to buy it, it can be really hard. You need a bottle of Advil, it's in plastic. So everything is in plastic. But I do think just becoming more conscious of the ways that you can reuse and not ask for plastic you don't need when you get takeout food, which a lot of us are getting. A lot of us are getting takeout food and bringing it home. You don't need to get the takeout plastic forks, you know, because you're going to eat it at home and those kinds of just thinking first in those small ways and asking questions when you have a chance to ask when you're at the store, where, you know, do you have this option in a glass bottle, or can I bring my own bags to the store? We talked about a lot of these things, but I think it's another good example of what Eric said. You know, I was a kid and my mom had her dorky grocery bags, like nobody else brought them to the store and it was weird and people looked at us funny. And now like, that's not true. You see someone doing it, you see how easy it is. Somebody gifts it to you and then you have that snowball effect that Eric mentioned. Mary, did you have something?
I was just going to say quickly that I think one part of the conversation is talking about the economics too, of how sometimes it's hard for people to access stuff that's more sustainable. And I think that's a big part of a conversation around plastics right now. I think it's, you do what you can. EcoSlow started a campaign around no new plastic for just a week, a month, and trying not to bring in any new plastic into your home and recognizing what you do have to see if you can reuse it. But I think this is a really good example of, you're wanting to get, you know, involved. There's kind of this, you know, personal changes you can make, but what can you get involved at a community level, a national level, around plastic? Because it's an industry that has to change. It's a system that has to change. And those are two different types of things.
We're about out of time for the segment, and I'm sorry. I believe we've probably created more questions for people than we have time to answer. But I think as long as people are paying attention and asking questions and thinking about it, that's going to move us in the right direction. Thank you to Mary, Lexi, and Eric today for being with us. We're going to take a quick break with the folks of the studio, and we will be back in a little bit with our guests from Cause, and we will talk about the economic factors with regard to the environment and climate change, because they are really critical and they are clear and they've been to some extent ignored for too long. We'll be back in a little bit. Brad, it's up to you in the studio.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, Alejandra Guzman is known by many as La Reina del Rock, the Queen of Rock en Español. We talk to her about her rebellious beginnings, the Mexican women who inspire her, and how she's learning to love her wrinkles.
Everybody thought I was going to die, but mala hierba nunca muere.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thanks for joining us today on KCBX. This afternoon, you can hear Latino USA coming up at 2 o'clock, followed by Fresh Air at 3, and then Marketplace at 4 o'clock right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Central Coast Voices continues here on KCBX. Let's join Fred Monroe and his guests.
Okay, thank you, Brad. Appreciate it. We are going to do the second half of the program today. We're still talking about an environmental issues. This is Earth Month. It is Earth Day, started 50 years ago, actually 51 years ago. And who joining us is going to be Lucas Zucker. He is the Policy and Communications Director for the Central Coast Alliance United for Sustainable Economy, for a sustainable economy. Sorry about that. Lucas, why don't we start with explaining the nature of the origin of your organization? Because I think for a lot of people, if we don't do that, it's going to be hard to understand why it's an environmental issue.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Fred. Yeah, so Cause was founded in 2001, and we actually came out of the living wage movement. And so we were really working to represent low-wage workers, low-income families here in the Central Coast, and fighting for economic justice. I think, you know, over time became more involved, around racial justice, immigrant rights. And around 2006, 2007 or so, we got involved in an environmental justice battle in Oxnard, which is, you know, kind of one of our, you know, main base areas. It's a community that's about 85% people of color, a lot of farm workers, you know, working class families. And there was a project proposed, a liquefied natural gas terminal that would have been the largest source of air pollution in Ventura County. And so, you know, for us, you know, at first we were going, well, hey, we work on economic issues, we work on social justice issues. You know, is this really something that we should be getting involved in? But for our members, for the folks who we were working with, they were saying, absolutely, this is part of our lives. You know, and our communities are being targeted for these polluting projects that would never be allowed in a wealthier community, in a wider community. And so from there, we continue to get involved in environmental justice issues, you know, locally and statewide, where communities of color and working class communities are really often bearing the brunt of toxic pollution.
But you brought up so many issues, and I'm going to try and sort this out. One of the things that I think may be an incredible frustration for your organization is that when you talk about things in Oxnard, we talk about the agricultural low-income communities. Historically, those communities have been reasonably quiet. Some of them are quiet because they are frankly too busy working and trying to keep their families alive to have any energy left to be verbal and vocal. Some of them have been quiet communities because there are some people who are not green card holders that were not born in this country that are part of those community. How do you balance out the fact that a good portion of the community that you're speaking of flat out doesn't have the time and the leftover energy to defend themselves, even though Absolutely. We agree they should?
Absolutely. And, you know, and I would say that those are huge factors, the economic, the kind of fear around immigration status, even the feeling that at a public meeting you're out of place, and even if they provide Spanish translation, you're the one sitting in the back having to wear the headsets and, you know, it doesn't feel like it's for you, or you don't want to, you know, say the wrong thing. There's so many factors keeping people from speaking up and having their voice in the political system. And I would say that, you know, despite that, our communities are really resilient, and our communities, you know, are not necessarily quiet. I mean, dating back to the original, I mean, when the city of Oxnard was formed in, you know, in 1900, this was actually one of the first, environmental justice and racial justice issues talked about. There's, you can look back, there's a book called Strategies of Segregation that recently came out that found, you know, history records in the newspaper that people in La Colonia, the neighborhood where Mexican people were segregated, were, you know, petitioning, protesting about the city dump being placed in their neighborhood, right? And so this is not a new thing of people kind of, despite the barriers, coming together and organizing and speaking up. But unfortunately, I think the power dynamics are such that often, you know, it's people from the most marginalized communities against some of the most powerful, wealthy corporations. And there's not enough resources that go to supporting the voice of folks from communities of color, from working class communities. And so, but I would say, despite that, I mean, incredible things have been accomplished. You know, in Oxnard in the 1990s, there was a group of farm worker parents who brought a lawsuit to the EPA, you know, and were able to get the first environmental justice settlement ever from the US EPA about, you know, pesticide spraying, you know, around the school where their kids went. And so although, you know, people face a lot of barriers to speaking up, folks also have a lot at stake and are willing to take risks, you know, when it's important to them.
The environmental community has been aware for a very long time about the fact that pesticides and chemical pollution is a key factor. They've generally spoken about it more from a standpoint of the consumer side. Right. It does appear, well, the politics of leverage sometimes is to people's benefit. So if there is a population that has been somewhat invisible to them, but that population becoming more active is going to help their cause, they become fair weather friends. Right. But we're still seeing a good portion of the communities of color with around these kind of economic issues ignored. Do you perceive the dialogue is improving with a better attitude towards immigrant issues, or are we just plodding along?
I think it's improving. Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, you know, the a lot of the conversation around, say, an issue like pesticides, you know, might have a long time ago really focused on, you know, your Whole Foods shoppers who you know, don't want to see pesticides on their fruit. And, you know, you have like lists, like the Dirty Dozen list of the, you know, fruits and vegetables with the highest pesticide exposure. And you see strawberries at the top of that, you know, list every year. And, you know, where do strawberries come from? Well, they come from communities here in the Central Coast, like Salinas, Santa Maria, Oxnard, that are overwhelmingly Latino, overwhelmingly, you know, a lot of low-income farm worker populations who both, you know, live alongside that, that fuming at pesticide exposure, as well as, you know, work in it. But I do think we are starting to see that change. I mean, certainly here in California, the politics is shifting, as you've got, you know, more legislators of color in the Capitol who are, you know, attuned to those issues, folks whose parents worked in the fields, you know, where 50 years ago, you wouldn't have seen that, you know, be the population that's actually making laws, right? I think it was interesting, even as the Biden administration came in, there was a you know, proposal for to have Mary Nichols, the head of the California Resources Board, be the, you know, the new EPA director. And environmental justice organizations, you know, people of color in the environmental movement said, you know, hey, she's you know, been involved in environmental causes, but, you know, on our issues, on environmental issues affecting people of color, she really hasn't been good. And the Biden administration withdrew that nomination and, you know, and picked a, you know, a black man who had a strong record of fighting for communities of color in the South. And so I think that's probably the first time that's ever happened on the national level. So you see that what started to happen in California has now even rippled nationwide.
It's come to mind that the two most powerful people in the House of Representatives on two different sides of the political spectrum are from California. Even though we hear people all the time talking about how people are leaving California and it's becoming a frustrating place to live. But what comes to mind, and one of the reasons I mentioned that, is that the most conservative political communities in California, with few exceptions, tend to be the agricultural areas of the state. But those are also areas where environmental pollution and the risk to basically farm workers and other agricultural workers is the most pronounced. My hunch is, and I'll be careful about the way I word this, but my hunch is that Kevin McCarthy is probably not at the top of your average discussion list on this topic, even though he represents one of the largest agricultural areas in the state. How are you folks looking at this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at you know, particularly communities like the Central Valley here in California, right, which is always at the top of national rankings of the worst air quality, you know, some of the worst water pollution from pesticide runoff, from runoff from, you know, oil drilling, you know, I mean, emissions from the huge, I mean, you know, people forget that California, you know, we talk a good talk about how we're a big, you know, big green state. You know, but we're one of the biggest oil producers in the country, you know, in the world, right? And a lot of that oil drilling is allowed to continue because it happens right next to, you know, low-income communities of color, right? And I think, you know, in a broader sense, the system that we live in is only possible because, you know, it involves sacrifice zones. You know, if power plants, oil refineries, you know, we're in everybody's backyard, I think we'd have a lot more, you know, environmental activism and energy, right? But they have often been invisibilized because they've been put in the communities with the least political power, the least political connections, the least resources to fight back. And, you know, areas like rural California are a strange dynamic, right? Because we've got a large farm worker population. We've got a lot of folks who can't vote, a lot of folks who don't vote because they feel like they've, you know, been left out. So they're communities that you could say are conservative in terms of their political representatives, but not necessarily in terms of their population. You've just got a lot of people who are you know, not being represented in the political system, and not being listened to by the folks in power.
Yeah. Want to remind, we have a few minutes left, folks. If you have some questions or some concerns that you'd like to share with Lucas, give us a call at 805-549-8855. You can also email us at voices@kcbx.org. If we can't get to them on the program or they're too complex for us to answer on the program, we will pass your email or your concerns along to Lucas Zucker. I'm talking with Lucas Zucker. He's the Policy and Communications Director for the Central Coast Alliance United for a Sustainable Economy. And this is a fascinating side of the economic / environmental movement together that doesn't get talked about very much. So, Lucas, I appreciate you being with us today. One of the things that comes to mind, and I don't know how, because hopefully we've done a reasonably good job of arresting it in a manner that was, for some of us, remarkably surprisingly effective. And I appreciate that. But one of the things that comes to mind is the community in San Luis Obispo County that had some of the first most significant exposure of cases to COVID was Paso Robles. And Paso Robles reminded us that that wasn't, and quite frankly, that wasn't really what they believed to be related to a conservative community as much as it may have been related to an agricultural community with a lot of people who were still working because they needed to work to sustain agriculture. Has COS looked at what the effect of COVID has been on the communities that you're most concerned about?
Absolutely. You look region wide throughout the Central Coast, right? And the cities that have been hit hardest are places like Oxnard, Santa Maria, Salinas, communities with large farm worker populations. And it makes sense, right? You know, you can't pick strawberries over Zoom. Folks who are, they are required to be out there in the fields, you know, exposed. And I would say particularly the biggest places we've seen outbreaks are, one, kind of packing house workers where people are, indoors, in a packing shed, kind of processing food, in close quarters. And also, especially, we've seen a huge growth in the Central Coast in the recent years of the H2A program, which is kind of a kindler, gentler, repackaged version of the old Bracero program, the guest worker program. And their workers are particularly vulnerable because they're brought here on seasonal visas. They live in shared bunk housing, kind of labor camp style. Are in shared transportation, often being bused in vans to the fields. And there's a lot of opportunity for exposure, as well as workers who are pretty vulnerable and don't know where to go for resources, don't know how to report problems. And so, absolutely, the farm worker community has really been ground zero, for folks who are hardest hit, as well as just folks who are paid an incredibly low wage for the work they do. That we're now recognizing as essential work, and yet, people are paid so little that they often have to double, triple up with other families in a single apartment just to survive. Again, increasing their exposure. And to tie back to the kind of the subject of the program here, I think in so many ways this COVID pandemic has been a preview of the problems that we'll see with climate change and particularly with social justice, right? And so farm workers are, really the population, in so many ways, most exposed to the harms of climate change, from, smoke to heat, right? Having to work outdoors, to kind of the economic insecurity and having their livelihoods disrupted. And then you look at the factors that folks simply don't have a safety net, right? When the majority of farm workers are undocumented, that means they're excluded from unemployment benefits. That means they've been excluded from federal stimulus benefits, are excluded from healthcare assistance, like the Affordable Care Act. And so when you've got folks who are, excluded from all of these safety nets, when you've got economic disruptions to their day-to-day jobs, when you've got, threats to their health, all of those things mean that they're much more at risk. And that affects all of us, because these are folks who are so essential to our communities, not just because of their work, but because they're just part of the fabric of our communities.
What are your national alliances? I mean, CAUSE is a regional organization. So, but what are the organizations that, we may want to become aware of on a national level that that have some clout with this? And I'm not trying to imply that you don't have clout. You guys are doing a wonderful job. But I think for a lot of people, what your visibility in the media is not necessarily a big factor, but national organizations seem to get a lot of editorial commentary.
Sure, sure. Well, nationally, we're part of a network called the Partnership for Working Families, and that's a national network that that works on worker issues, labor issues, but really tries to intersect and connect those issues to issues affecting communities, you know, around things like immigration, housing, you know, the criminal justice system, and the environment. Statewide here in California, you know, for folks interested in learning more about the environmental justice movement, there's a really great network that we're part of called the California Environmental Justice Alliance, or CEJA. And they're the ones that have moved a lot of the legislation in California, you know, focusing certain environmental programs, you know, on the communities who are most burdened by pollution, communities of color that are most impacted, you know, and fighting the hard fights for communities that are living right alongside power plants and oil drilling, and heavy duty trucking routes and things like that.
So you talked earlier, a lot of voices for that are strong support for what you're doing are getting heard in Washington. People who are strong support for these issues are getting in the Biden administration. Do you have confidence that what the public expects in the direction that you want to go is indeed where we're going to go for the next 4 years?
Not 100% confidence. I mean, I think we've got a long way to go. I think, you know, environmental justice, even as a concept, is just starting to get on, I think, the public radar, right? You know, I think 10 years ago, you did not see the phrase mentioned in mainstream newspapers. You certainly didn't see it mentioned at the national level, you know, maybe just barely at the state level here in California. Now the conversation is beginning to come mainstream, but I think that's the first step towards, you know, policy really changing. And so it's a long process, you know, but I think we're starting to see us turn around the corner.
Yeah. One of the things that you, when I was, the notes that you provided us to be able to understand your topic a little better, You talked about a particular issue, which I kind of put in the category of it's a head scratcher. Affordable housing tends to be built in areas that may be the most environmentally irresponsible, near landfills, near chemical plants. The flip side of that is, and by the way, I absolutely agree with that frustration, but the flip side is, for housing to be purchased and built, it needs to be built on reasonably inexpensive land, or we can't afford to build the housing. So I'm wondering how that kind of balancing act really gets addressed, because the economic supply and demand is something you can't ignore.
And I would say, you know, part of there's maybe a misconception that. You know, the reason that low-income communities are you know, right next to pollution sources is because it's happened because people live where it's cheap, which is next to the polluting factory or something, right? But it also happens the reverse, right? Which is that communities that are low-income, communities of color, you know, often those polluting sources are put next to communities that are already there, put next to affordable housing. And so really, I would say the causation is not necessarily one way or the other. Part of the problem is that city leaders, county leaders at our local level, you know, have historically looked at both affordable housing and toxic, you know, heavy industrial sites as unwanted land uses, things that nobody wants in their backyard. And they've stuck them both. They you know, they're considering poor people of color, and, you know, things like a literal, you know, dump or, a toxic plant as kind of the same thing. And they've dumped them both in the same areas. And so we've got to completely change that dynamic, right? And we've got to restore, you know, the environment around communities that have had the burden for so long. You know, and allow affordable housing to be built in often neighborhoods that have been, you know, exclusionary, right? And not allowed apartments to be built, not allowed, you know, affordable projects to be built.
Yeah, good point. And as most of my regular listeners know, I talk too much, and therefore I try and work real hard to make sure that my guests get their last word. So please, what do you want to make sure that, people walk away with today as a better understanding of what CAUSE does and what they should think about?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think as I mentioned earlier, the kind of the unjust and unsustainable system that we live in, you know, is made possible because of sacrifice zones, because of places that you are not meant to see, where the dirtiest edge of things are placed, you know, because people have less power and less resources to fight against the incredibly powerful and wealthy interests, you know, that are, you know, benefiting from that. And what it really requires to change that system, and what it will require to stop climate change, what it will require to create a sustainable world, is for all of us to be aware of those sacrifice zones, and for people to get beyond their bubbles, right? And be able to, you know, see and respect and value and fight for neighborhoods that, you know, are the kind of places that they never go, right? The kind of places that they think of as, you know, as unwanted places, and recognize there are people there who call those places home, who have the same rights they do to, you know, raise their kids in a healthy environment, you know, and live long and happy lives. And that often requires standing up to power, and standing up to money, right? But it's going to take all of us together. And so that's what I'll end it on.
That's very good. I think that really has us paying attention. I think that you've done a very good job of making it very clear that environmental issues and economic issues, especially for communities of color, are reality we have to pay attention to. Thanks for joining us today. This has Thanks, been Fred. Central Coast Voices. I want to remind you, Chris Kington Barker will be with you next week. Chris is going to take a look at the American Indian Health Services program, dealing with the health and well-being of Native Americans and Alaskan Natives. And she will be talking with folks from that program in Santa Barbara County next week. I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. This has been Central Coast Voices, which, as you know, is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County, along with KCBX in their collaboration. You can reach us at voices@kcbx.org with any comments or program suggestions you may have. This has been a wonderful program. Thank you to my guests, Mary Szczesinski, Lexi Bell, Eric Viem, and Lucas Zucker, for being with us today to really take a look at environmental issues and how they are tied together with economic issues and communities that we sometimes don't pay enough attention to. I thank you very much. This has been Central Coast Voices. We'll be back with you next week.
Thanks for tuning in to Central Coast Voices. This show will be available to listen to later today on our website, kcbx.org. You can hear any of our local shows anytime and stream on demand from kcbx.org. Find us on social media at kcbxfm.